defense attorneys Larry Douglas and Pat McCann, Huntsville Report outside the death house, Linda Huhon, special guest, former death row inmate Clinton Young, and a very special guest tonight, Gary Green himself, in an unedited death row interview he did recently with host Marlo Blue. The execution watch for Gary Green begins.
This is the first of two scheduled executions this week by the state of Texas. Tonight, Gary Green, and on Thursday, March the 9th, Arthur Brown. To our listeners around the world, thank you for joining us on this Tuesday, March the 7th edition of Execution Watch. I'm Marlo Blue. If you're tuning in for Coming to America on KPFT Houston, they will be back next week in their 6 o'clock time slot. This show brings you live news coverage as the state of Texas plans to execute 51-year-old Gary Green, convicted in the 2009 double homicide in Dallas, Texas. I interviewed Mr. Green in Livingston at the Polanski unit on February the 22nd. If the execution proceeds, and only if it proceeds, we will air that final interview in its entirety and unedited. You know, normally we go straight to our reporter, Linda Snyder, in Huntsville, but tonight we're going to first go and talk with our chief legal analyst, Mr. Larry Douglas. So talk about this, please, Larry.
As you know, Marlo, this is a horrible case, as almost all death penalty cases are. Gary Green, comes out of Dallas, Texas. And Gary Green grew up in Dallas, went to high school there in Dallas. Coming out of high school, he got into a little bit of trouble. He had a drug case that he did probation for, and he had a robbery case that he did that he was sentenced to 20 years on. Gets out of prison, and he gets into a relationship with a young lady, Lavetta Armstead. Now, during his life, Mr. Green had some major mental health issues. He was diagnosed with major depressive disorder. He was psychotic, schizophrenia, bipolar. And his brother said, you know, there was always something a little bit wrong with Gary. He and Lavetta Armstead had only been married for a few months. And she decided that she had three children, a daughter and two older sons. She decided that the relationship was not working out. So she'd put him out, and then she let him come back in. And we came back in, it still didn't work out. So they'd been married for a short amount of time. Now the reporters suggest whether it was a divorce or an annulment, but she told Gary one day that, you know, this is just not working out. Probably never still let you come back in, but it's time for you to go. We need to part ways. I love you, but we can't, it's just not working. She wrote him two notes same day. He writes her a note back saying that he's going to kill five people. The last is going to be himself, herself, her daughter, her two sons, and then himself. And then he, according to his, he gave a lengthy videotape confession. According to his confession, he, this little girl was 6 years old. He put tape around her mouth, tied her up, and then went to the bedroom and killed her mother. Lavetta didn't go down without a struggle. They fought. She took the cover off the tank on the toilet, tried to hit him with that. He started stabbing her. Stabbed her, according to his confession, 30 times. She was able to stab him a couple of times toward the back with just superficial wounds. But she died. He said, I stabbed her about 30 times, not all at once. She dies. Then he takes the little girl and drowns her in the tub. After he does that, he takes a shower himself and then goes to church and picks up the two little boys, preparing to kill them. And he gets back to the house and stabs the younger boy. The older boy, just stricken with fear, can't say anything. The younger boy talks his way out of it, says, you know, we love each other, and I'm just too young to die. So what we could do is we'll let us go. He relents and says, I think I'll better not tell anybody. And then he shows them their mother and little sister's bodies, according to him. And they say they just broke down crying. Then he told them to go get his medicine, his pills. And he took 30 tablets of Tylenol and Benadryl. And he says, don't call the police until I'm gone. So he left, went home, and then seemed to recover because they found him in one of his friend's houses. They took him to the hospital. And so he had a trial. But the lengthy confession that he gave, because the details of what all happened came from him, from his videotaped confession. The trial was one, as we discussed earlier, Marlo, this is the kind of case that it fits the definition of a death penalty case. The prosecutor has the discretion as to whether to seek it, though. And with the amount of outrage, clearly from the family, they were looking for retribution, and they were able to get it. At trial, the tactic seemed to be to use the fact that he had mental health issues to allow him to escape the death penalty. The guilt as a murder, capital murder, was almost foregone conclusion. But then future danger and mitigation were the issues. And in terms of mitigation, his lawyers had an expert, Dr. Gilbert Martinez. And Dr. Martinez, the testimony suggested that he was mentally impaired, mentally disabled. The problem is that he had an IQ from the doctor. The doctor gave a battery of exams, and his IQ was as low as 78. But he'd been to prison before, and during prison, his IQ was shown to be 105. So the evidence on future danger, they brought in two of his girlfriends who he had when they tried to break up with him, he had choked them out. And on mitigation, the evidence was deemed not by the jury not to be sufficient in terms of his intellectual disability.
Let me.
We don't have Skype yet. Keep going.
Okay.
Now I understand that you interviewed him. How was that, Marlo? When you went up I've interviewed a few, but it always leaves me with a. Reading the materials is one thing, but going in and visiting with a person that the state is preparing to die leaves a deep impression on a person. How was it for you?
I am extremely disturbed by the entire incident. The interview itself was talking to, I don't want to give anything away, but I found talking to Mr. Green incredibly humanizing. And we give you statistics, we give you facts, we tell people about things and the death that is coming, but to sit across from somebody and the glasses in there and feeling a connection with another human being is something that is, I don't I don't know how people do this on a regular basis. I really don't. And I won't lie to you. It's been incredibly disturbing for me. Pat McCann, you're here. Thank you for joining us tonight. And as we discuss this trial, what do you see in it? What are you bringing up?
You know, this is a marriage that dissolved, and it dissolved with one of the partners who was very mentally ill. He had been hospitalized about a month before this incident. He attempted suicide the night of the incident. He turned himself in with family to the police station. It is almost textbook in the sense of if the diagnosis is correct that he had schizoid affective disorder, that means you have the worst of both bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. So you not only have delusions, but you also have the manic aspects and depressive aspects of bipolar. As a layperson, I've grappled with that with a few clients. It is enormously difficult to get them to focus in on what's actually in front of them. And I think one of the tragedies of this is that we don't have a good education or understanding for most people, particularly jurors, about the effects of mental illness on this. And this was obviously someone who had a breakdown. It is tragic, and no one says that this makes things okay, but to execute him for what is obviously a psychotic break seems like a very tough step to take forward. And I'm certain this fellow, as I understand it, is fairly huge. I'm well over 6 feet tall, well over 300 pounds. So a physically frightening person is obviously someone that has admitted to killing a child, is obviously someone that people are going to have very little sympathy for. But there seems to be strong evidence that if he is not actually what we would call mentally retarded, he's close, and he has mental illness. It's a tragic combination and a difficult one to overcome.
Right now, let's go join our reporter outside of the Death House in Huntsville, Linda Snyder. Hello, Linda. Any news?
Hi. How are you doing? Can you hear us?
Yes, we certainly can. And I see that you have another one of our new panel members. You have Meryl Pontier there with you.
Yes.
Thank you for joining. Is this your first execution to actually be protesting in person, Meryl?
Yeah, it is. This is the first time I'm actually here. And I was at Polunsky today visiting clients, and I saw Gary Green having his last visit before they took him away at noon today to be transported to the Huntsville unit.
Linda?
Yes.
Do you have any questions for Meryl?
No, we're waiting for them to cross. They haven't crossed yet.
Right. Meryl, how does it look in person to you? What are you seeing that is different from what you expected?
Well, apparently I was just on the wrong side. We walked over here, me and my assistant, and there's people here now who are in favor of executions. And so they're protesting, or I guess supporting these executions on the other side of the unit. So I was actually on the wrong side at first. But, you know, I guess the good thing is I talked to those people for a while, and they explained to me why they're in favor of executions, and I explained to them why I'm not. And I gave the example of Clint's case and how he's innocent and spent 20 years on death row. And they actually said they were going to watch his documentary. So, I think that was good. We respectfully agreed to disagree. But other than that, it's for me, it's a good reminder for why I do this work. You know, it's kind of a little bit overwhelming to stand here and, you know, knowing that someone's about to die on the inside of this unit. We're standing in the road.
Linda, do we know who is actually standing witness for Gary Green?
His brother and his cousin.
His brother and his cousin. I know his mother is still alive, so is she?
He asked his mother not to come because she's taking this very hard, and he didn't want to see her today. She came Saturday night to visit him.
So she did see him again.
Yes, she did. She cries all the time, and that was upsetting to Gary, so he asked her not to come to this.
All right. So who is out there today? I believe I see Maureen Monk there. I see the Rev. Are there many people who are protesting the death penalty?
Oh, there's a lot of people out here protesting, yes.
On both sides, eh?
Yeah, can you see everybody? There's a lot.
Yeah, that is a lot. Meryl, the people that you talked to, were they specifically protesting Gary Green's execution, or were they just for execution in general?
They explained to me that they are supporting these executions in general, and that like three executions ago, they realized that people were out here protesting executions, and so they felt like they needed to kind of show the other side, and they felt like they needed to protest, I guess, us or support executions. So their intention is to just stand here every time there's an execution to show support, because they said there's also people on the other side protesting. So it kind of equals it out, I guess, is how I understood it.
Right, right. That's very interesting. Well, thank you for letting them know about Clinton's documentary. Maybe that'll give them some other information that they never had before.
I think so. I think it did. Yeah, they were interested. And I said, we talked for about 15 minutes. And
right.
I told them I never try to convince people to be against the death penalty.
Right.
But I think, you know, educating people is important. And so they explained to me why they're in favor, and so I explained why I'm against it, and innocence is a big reason, and they were actually very receptive to that argument, and they said they were going to watch the documentary, so.
Oh, well, there you go. That's all victories are good, yes, in this case.
Exactly.
Linda, are you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay. I'm just watching to see when they cross, but they have not crossed yet.
Okay. Just let us know, please.
Okay. All right. We will.
Thank you so much. And we're going to go back into this discussion with Pat and with Larry. And let's bring Clinton in, too, if we may. Clinton Young is also a new member of our panel. Clinton, he's one of our new reporters, as a matter of fact. He has done over 18 years on Texas's death row. So he has a very unique unique perspective that he can tell us. Clinton, can you hear us as well?
Yeah, if I start coughing and stuff, I got a very unique sinus infection. So.
We do not like unique sinus infections. Yeah. We do not like sinus infections.
Yeah,
at
you
all.
Know, I was just sitting there thinking about Meryl said that there's people protesting it. I mean, standing in support of it. Sometimes people just want to be adversarial. I understand that, but like, you generally don't have to stand up for something that's already in existence and, mm-hmm. and operational. You know, normally people stand up is because they're against what they're standing up for. And it's like, you know, Texas is going into death penalty any day soon. So I got better things to do than go out there and stand at night just because I believe in the death penalty or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't, you know, I mean, like, dang, ain't y'all got something better to do than stand out here? I understand they're protesting against something, but they're just standing out there to say they support it. Okay, you're from Texas. It's understood generally that chances are you support the death penalty.
Yeah.
Now, Clinton, did you know Gary?
Yeah, I knew Gary. Yeah, I lived on a section a couple times with him, right? I could tell, I mean, he wasn't a problematic, like, prisoner or anything like that. But I could tell, like, sometimes, especially during, like, the COVID lockdowns hit a lot of people real hard because that's when we couldn't need to sell it all for, like, months. But I could tell there was times, like, I'm not surprised to learn that he has some underlying mental illness issues, right? I mean, I'm not going to say he was bat crap crazy or anything like that. But it's little conversations, right? Like, there was, I could tell, like, paranoia and things like that. That when y'all mentioned, I heard y'all mention the diagnosis, I was like, okay, that makes sense, right?
Yeah. Thank you. Talk a little bit, Clinton, about medication on death row. I mean, you know, well, like, do people...
Go ahead.
No. You know, it's a question. I mean, do people get the medications that they needed?
No, I mean, you know, I use Tracy Beatty as an example, who was executed a while back.
Absolutely.
The Tracy Beatty that was on, that y'all had the recording of on that show when he was executed, that's not the Tracy Beatty I knew the whole time I was on death row, right? And after talking to some of his team a couple weeks ago, they said they finally got his medication right.
Yeah.
All right. And so, which meant they didn't give him the medication he needed until they needed to kill him. And that's generally how it is, right? I mean, it's like it's prison healthcare. And so the mental health services is even worse. Their idea of a mental health check is to walk around every 90 days and say, "You okay?" And you could tell them, somebody's talking to me through the vent, blah, blah, blah. And they say, okay. And they'll just write down, inmates fine. And then keep walking, right? I mean, that's just, it's a dog and pony show, the medical care in general, but it's even worse when it comes to mental health services.
Gentlemen.
Mental health issues are difficult, both in and out of the criminal justice system. It's you reach the point where you just don't know what to do. I know Jim Skelton used to comment that, you know, well, what are you going to do with him?
You know, real quick, Larry, before I forget, please, forgive me for interrupting you. You mentioned something about the mental health, and it triggered a memory. When I was down there talking in Austin to the legislation, the House Committee on Criminal Jurisprudence, a few people after me was Brian Collier, the executive director for TDCJ. And he told them, he gave like a general rundown report about prisoners, stuff like this, number of prisoners, on and on and on. And he mentioned healthcare and mental health services. And he said something like, I mean, don't quote me on this precise number, but this is basically what he said. He said 20 or 15 years, 10 years ago, they had, say, 120,000 people in Texas prison system. They had 27,000 mentally ill inmates. Now they only got like 92,000 people in prison, but they got 35,000 mentally ill inmates. And so the prison population has shrunk, but the number of mentally ill prisoners has risen. And that was his official testimony to the Texas House Committee on Criminal Justice.
And you know, one comment on that is that number is actually low. One of the things that TDCJ does not do a good job of is actual screening, because they take people from the jails where they don't get screened either a lot of times. Harris County actually does a decent job of trying to document at least the major three illnesses, depression, schizophrenia, and bipolar disorder. But the truth is that it doesn't screen for PTSD. It doesn't screen for any kind of traumatic problems. It doesn't screen for traumatic brain injury that occurs all too often in a lot of individuals, that robs them of their ability to deal with folks in a lot of ways and control their behavior. It does a poor job, and that's because we all do a poor job of screening for intellectual disability. So in terms of the numbers that Clinton was just talking about, that's probably a low, pretty low estimate of the number of people, because TDCJ does not catch them and doesn't do a good enough job of screening for them. And remember, their screening is not for therapeutic reasons. It's to medicate and manage their inmates. So
yeah.
They're looking at, please, Clinton, go ahead and take that.
No, I mean, no, that's just true, right? I mean, it's all about warehousing people, right? And so they don't care about a person getting fixed. They just want to be able to control the prisoner. But I interrupted you, Larry. I apologize, man. What were you saying now?
No, I think it was a good interruption, because the warehousing is a factor. For instance, on death row, you know, you know this better than anyone, Clinton, is you're in basically solitary confinement. A lot of those individuals have severe problems, and the amount of treatment is non-existent other than medication. And even that's done on a budget constraint.
Let me go quickly. Merrill, Linda, do you have something to report?
Yes, the news media went across, but we didn't see any witnesses go. I was told that Gary's brother and his cousin were going to witness, but they said that they didn't go across. It was just the news media.
All right, thank you. And in your experience, because you certainly have more experience in this than most people, can you tell me, what do you think that means?
I guess either today Gary asked him not to, he decided he didn't want any witnesses, or, you know, I don't know. We're just waiting now to see if we come back across.
All right.
We assume it's going on, but I don't know, maybe not.
Well, the media across the road, it's going on.
Okay.
Well, with that, let's go ahead and air Mr. Green's interview, please.
Still for a second.
So you are listening to KPFT 90.1 FM Houston and Houston Media Source TV here, also in Houston. Thank you for joining us. If you had tuned in for Coming to America on KPFT, they will be back next week in their regular time slot at 6 p.m.
Okay, we're
ready. And let's start the interview now, please.
Does it work most of the time? Or?
All the time. Yeah, it works perfect. And, yeah, I always loved the show, not so much for, you know, the execution, but
yeah.
I enjoy the show because it's real informative, and being able to hear the guys' voices that, you know, you have a relationship with, and
yeah.
Speak volumes, you know.
Well, so, you know, that's good to know. What do you all like to hear? Because we want to make the show, you know, we're aiming it at you.
Well, the way that the last one I heard was, you was talking to Brother Robert Muhammad.
Yeah.
And this was Ruiz's execution on the first.
Yeah.
And they were very informative, and
it was a different show.
Humane as well.
Yeah.
Because it humanized him in a manner that brought forth some things that I wasn't aware of myself.
Mm-hmm.
About the logistics of how everything transpired. But yeah, it was well put together. I appreciate that.
Thank you. We appreciate. Mm-hmm. I'm just so happy you decided to talk like this. And this is yours. This is your chance to say whatever you want to say and whatever you want to talk about.
Well, the opportunity that presented itself, I wanted to shed light on this environment and make it bring some humanity to it from both sides of the spectrum, because prison is a place, death row is a place that's, yes, solitary confinement, but it's a place also whereas an individual can grow, learn, benefit. It's all kind of benefits on many levels that if a person is willing to put forth the time, because we don't have nothing but time.
Yeah.
You know, you have a man in prison have an opportunity that people like Bill Gates and Zuckerberg and so forth, they wish that they had, and that is time. They got plenty of money, they just don't have time. And we have plenty of time and to make it beneficial. I used to believe when I got here that being here was a curse, and I realized that it was a blessing. You know, and you got to have a mindset of are you a glass half full or a glass half empty, and I always viewed myself as being one half full. So I spent my time here trying to better myself every day and trying to make the world a better place best way we can.
Well, it sounds like you've kind of formed new philosophies about life.
I have.
And that as restricting as this environment is, you've just grown like a flower.
Yeah, I like to consider it. It's funny you mention that about the flower, because I always considered myself to be the rose that grows within the cracks of the concrete. And I think that's true for many of us. I've seen a lot of guys here blossom and continue to blossom to be beautiful human beings. And of course, you got the yin and yang everywhere.
Oh, sure.
You know, that, but for the most part, it's a lot of guys that's, because life is what you put into it. And then you have, when I got here, this place was very dark. A place of no opportunities, and now you have faith-based, you have visitors, opportunity to eat free world food, you have classes that you can take, which I took numerous of them, a slew that take time to mention, and then you have televisions in the day room, you have tablets, a lot of things on the horizon that's this place has been beneficial. And you know, you got officers, you got staff that's saying that I'm praying for you. This long before I was ever on death watch, and it just I take pride in seeing the opportunity of the transformation, not just with the people in white, but the transformation of the staff and the guards, because the culture is constantly changing every day, where everybody's not just being judgmental.
Yeah.
It's viewing you as a human being, that this person in white can be my brother-in-law, or it can be me. And it's a beautiful environment. I mean, it's not where you want to be, but if you have to be here, it's a beautiful environment, if that's what you're working towards. And my goal to give this interview, well, I thank my brother Cantu, which is on the Sex and Women Death Watch, and which I've been knowing for years. And I asked him, I said, he had the interview with you guys, and I said, hey man, I lost the contact. Could you contact them and let them know that if the interview is aired, then that means that I'm not here anywhere, so it really wouldn't matter. Mm-hmm. So I said, you know, I know brothers that I've been knowing for years, that like T. Irvin, that brother been here since the 70s, and the point that I'm trying to make, I owe it to the brothers that I have built bonds with, as well as the people that I don't have a bond with and don't know, that I owe it to them to try to help make this place a better place for them and the guys that that may come tomorrow, which I hope not, but if they do, then the aim is to try to do what I can to make it better. And hopefully that this interview will make it just that much better for them, to where people on the outside, people on the inside, they will hear it, that they will say that we're not just the boogeyman that society say that we are. We are people sons and daughters, and you know, you had the female unit. You have several of them, I believe, and so just try to bring some humanity to the place, because everybody here is not just here twiddling their thumbs. They're really trying to make transformations and make the best of their situation. A lot of them do. You know, you got guys that have been here that never had, never knew how to read and write, and they taught themselves how to do that, and they thriving. And it's good to witness the diamond in the rough. Yeah, it's a lot of things that transpired that we all not in agreement with, but I like to always think that the best beautiful thing in the world and around the world is diamonds and gems, and they forged through what? Much pressure, much heat, thousands of degrees of heat and pressure, and so heat and pressure, it's not necessarily a bad thing if you use it to benefit yourself, because a negative can be turned into a positive, and I think that that's what we all try to do, being in this situation here.
You are a philosopher, sir.
I appreciate that, but I think that what it is that I don't speak from a script. And when you don't speak from a particular script, you just, I'm a man that just speak from the heart. And when you speak from that always tell the truth, you know.
Well, how's your heart doing these days?
My heart bleeds for the people that love me, the people that's, and it is, just ask me that, it really get me choked up, because it make me think about it. Just yesterday, I was out here in visitation, and my mother and my brother came to see me, and I was telling them that the reason why I haven't called them in a month, and I won't call them, and I didn't want them to come back after yesterday, and was due to be executed is one thing, but to walk to your own death is another. And I can do that if I'm only thinking about me. But to have to focus on someone else, somebody that I love, because when I love somebody, I love them, whether it's a friend, family, I love unconditionally. And I think my problem has always been I love too hard. So with that said,
say a little something to them, Gary. Say something to them. Speak to
them. They didn't understand at first when I told them not to come back, but they understood before the visit was up, and I told them that that we spent a lot of time on our side loving each other, a lot of good memories, because we was a close-knit family, you know. And I loved them a lot. My mother has always been like my sister, because I never had a sister. And I'm the firstborn, and she was, her name is Mary, and my name is Gary. So it's not because she wanted a girl, it's just that she wanted to emphasize the closeness. And so right, wrong, and different, my mother has always been that the first woman, first female that I ever loved in my life.
And, love is a powerful thing, there, Gary.
My heart bleeds for her. Me, I'm all right, I mean. I just bleed. I hurt for the people that I love, because if I could take their pain, I would, but I can't.
Well, that's what love's all about, Gary. And I know that just them being here means they love you. Just Just them being here means they care about you. Yeah. And you know that, and your heart is full, and that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's just oftentimes we, a person may forget that being here, we're not the only one to hear. When we hear, we think we get caught up in ourselves and get caught up in self-pity sometimes to believe that you're the only one here, you're the only one. But it's people behind the scenes that they heart bleed, that they hurt because people that love us, they incarcerated too.
And, yeah. We all cross the river.
Yeah. And those things like that always keep me going when I feel myself going down the rabbit hole of life, and so I don't get stuck in that rut. I think about that if it's one person in this world that care about me, then I got to keep pushing and fighting on for them, and because it's not about that's what helped me come out of suicidal tendencies my whole life, being here in solitary confinement. That's what I was talking about earlier about I thought it was a curse, but it turned out to be a blessing, that it helped me to really look inside myself and ask myself, who am I, you know, who, what make you tick, you know what I mean? Not the things that we put on for a facade to say that we masquerading to say this is who I am and to the world. I'm talking about those items of like clothing that we put on and when we looking at ourselves and say, who are you? Who are you? What is your true essence? What are your weaknesses? What are your flaws? And try to fix those things, and that's what I have always tried to do, because for nobody but me, because I owe it myself to try to get this ship right. And the ship that I'm talking about, the shipwreck that I've been on my whole life, you know, I told people that when I was at that I was on death row. And how can that be? Is that you know, self-destructive behavior. We medicate to escape whatever type sex addict, using unprotected sex, all kind of things that we do to self-medicate and self-destructive behavior. And I'm glad that you know, not the circumstances, but I'm just glad I had the opportunity to put myself in the shop, so to speak, and work on those things.
Give it a little check over there, yeah. See what's going on and what condition you are in. So let me ask, do you want to say anything to anybody? Do you want to?
Well, all the people. There's so many people that have impacted my life on numerous levels, on the outside the fence and within the perimeters of the fence, the various guards, various staff. I mean, I just feel really blessed to have known people placed in my life when I the energy running low and I need to be fueled up, and everybody say, whether it's another guy in white, guard or staff, and say, hey man, I really appreciate you for no reason. And this happened many times throughout the years, often. And so it's a lot of guys, a lot of people I would like to say thank you to, and everybody that I came in contact with, a lot of brothers back here. There's some beautiful human beings that gave me the strength, and they didn't even know it, to just keep going. And I love them all. I mean, because I don't look at the good things in life all the time. I look at the storms too, because the storms is what makes us who we really are, because that shows the resilience of a person when you can walk through a storm and you can come out the other side and not always just focusing on the sunny days and birds are chirping. You want to, you know, cast a lot of light on the storms too, because those bumps and bruises are really what makes us who we are. And God knows I have a lot of them. I wake up every day with aches and pains and that I don't even know nothing about.
So, Mr. Green, we got about 3 more minutes, but they're not giving us much time these days. We want to know what you have to, anything else to say in this last minute.
What I want to say to the brothers that's here is that that they have take the time, continue, if you're not taking the time, but continue to take the time to improve on yourself, and you owe it to yourself, you owe it to your family, you owe it to the people that love you. So to make yourself a better you, because a better you make a better world. And to all the brothers that feel like they're in a hopeless situation, they about to give up, they want to give up, throw in the towel, that it's always somebody in the worst situation. And to show that you got what it takes to continue on, that you won in a million. We never won the lottery, but in a sense of monetary value, but we all won the lottery, because there's hundreds of millions of sperm cells racing to create the you, the me, all of us. And we won the race. Whether we born with Down syndrome or born into poverty, it doesn't make no difference, but you won in a million. You here, and that's
we're
what I
already
want to
here. That's winners, right?
You know, and you're a winner. And we just got to play the hand that life dealt us, and make the best of it, and always know that to everybody, the guards, the staff, the brothers in white, the people on our side, the society, that if don't nobody love you, I love you, because love is universal for the world, and that's the most powerful weapon in the world to heal us all. To know that somebody genuinely love you for just you, and you say to yourself, why would you love me, and how can you love me? You don't even know me. Well, it's easy, because people hate for no reason. So why can I not love for just the reason, just because I'm you and you are me, and that's why I love you.
You remember Ray Hill, Mr. Green?
I do. I really do.
Well, Ray Hill always used to tell us, I love you, and there ain't nothing you can do about it.
That's right. That's a beautiful thing, and I'm glad that that a man like that came along and made a lot of things possible. And we all stand on the shoulders of somebody else, and that's why we owe the things that we do in life for others, because we're having this opportunity, this platform, is because of others. The donations of the people around the world to KPFT made it possible for me to be here, to be able to get this interview, to have the cameras, the microphones, all this stuff costs money. So, you know, I'm thankful for that opportunity. Somebody to say that those coins that's in between the pillars of the couch, and he said, I'm going to donate to KPFT.
We were just talking about that spare change in the couch.
That, all that little things like that, it can change the world. It's not the mountains that we can move all at one time. You can move a mountain by a grain of sand, a grain of dirt, one at a time, and that's all we can do. And I appreciate you guys for giving me this opportunity. And I'm not just saying that loosely. I really do appreciate it, because y'all do some beautiful work. And it goes unrecognized sometimes. And I want you to know that it's not going unrecognized with us. And I really appreciate that. If I could, I'd give all y'all a hug, but unfortunately.
We'll take it. We'll take it. We'll feel it and I'll pass it on. I sure will.
I appreciate that. And I appreciate y'all.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
We're back. Still no word from the Walls unit as to whether or not the execution has taken place. We expect that it will. I'm Pat McCann, and this is Execution Watch. I wanted to ask my fellow panel member and Harris County colleague, how do you deal with clients that are mentally ill?
Well, Pat, as we were discussing earlier, the thing about mentally ill clients is that they range so.
True.
Some are marginally mentally ill and some are severely mentally ill. And on the serious cases, the issue is if they're seriously mentally ill, what do we do with them? That becomes a problem. My mentor, Jim Skelton, said, you know, don't push that mental illness too far, because sometimes it raises the question in the system, what do we do with them now? But having watched that eye-opening video of Gary Green, he seemed to be very stable.
He was composed. He was well-spoken. He was actually giving us some real wisdom in terms of, I thought it was great when he sat there and responded, you know, Zuckerberg and other people, they have lots of money, but prison gives you something everybody wants, time.
Philosophical. I mean,
yeah.
he was a total philosopher at that moment.
I know.
And the severity of his mental illness could cause him the problem to be where he is today, because when the jury looks at him and sees the activity that he's engaged in and how clearly he seems to be thinking,
they don't see the madness. In other words,
they don't see it,
right?
And the mental health information provided by the defense regarding his IQ being 78. That's not the 70 and below presumptive amount degree, and that's 78 or 79. But he'd also had a mental health evaluation in prison where he tested 105. So that raises something of a question, along with the seeming clear thinking in his the notes that he wrote that same day. So the issue of abandonment, rage, seemed to be fairly clear. But what does that even mean? So the thing about the mental issue altogether is that it is just so undefinable, seemingly.
We're going to go back now to Linda. Linda, can you hear us down here? We seem to lack some audio. Can you hear us now? Okay, I just lip read that.
I'm sorry.
No problem. Okay, Linda, I saw that you could hear us. We can't hear you quite yet. Can you nod your head if the witnesses have crossed back? They have not. Okay, so we have no confirmation yet then. Clinton, is your phone up and can you hear us and respond?
We've lost Skype, I believe, but it's actually time for us to pretty much wrap up for the day. Any parting words, gentlemen?
Just I want everyone to understand that, as tragically was shown tonight, but for his mental illness, we would not be witnesses to this.
And on that note, a mental illness is so difficult for people to understand. they look at people and think, hey, there's nothing wrong with that person now. And then they compare that to the actions that he took. And they and the whole attitude then is like, we've got to hold him accountable for it. There's nothing wrong with him. And that's the difficulty in varying degrees of mental illness.
All right. Well, it is time to wrap up Execution Watch for today. Please join us Thursday, March 9th, when Texas plans to usher Arthur Brown into the death chamber in Huntsville, Texas. And then again on the 29th for Annabelle Andy Canales. If it does, Execution Watch will cover the state-sanctioned killing with our live news coverage. We welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. To learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas, we're on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. Thank you to our legal analysts, Larry Douglas, Pat McCann, and Merrill Pontier. To our reporters, Linda Snyder and Clinton Young, video director Mark Pertle, technical director Otis McClay, engineer Howard Reynolds, social media Zara Sheridan, executive producer Elizabeth Ann Stein. For those of you listening on KPFT 90.1 FM, stay tuned for Nuestra Palabra with Tony Diaz. On behalf of the Execution Watch crew, I'm Marlo Blue. Good night.
Name. Where's all that?